CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News comes to us from the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And this has been chosen based on our guest being the CEO of a nonprofit. And the article goes like this. Six nonprofits get an early crack at the new Twitter brand profiles. And the article's written by Cody Switzer. Twitter has given six nonprofits an early chance to test out its new brand page design, which seeks to give users more effective ways to promote their work. And this article that was just released in December of 2011 in the Chronicle of Philanthropy goes on to say, the American Red Cross, Create Jobs for USA, Global Citizen Year, Gray Area Foundation for the Arts, Kiva, and Room to Read now have pages that feature new banners and space to display a promoted tweet with a video. And these early adopters say they expect the new layout to help them connect more effectively with followers and others who see their Twitter pages. If they come to our Twitter page for the first time, it's a great way to take a peek at what we are all about in a more curated way than there has been in the past, said Shauna Carey, communications associate at Room to Read. The organization this week promoted a tweet that encourages supporters to contribute to the organization's holiday wish list campaign. The promoted tweet includes a link that directs supporters to a donation page and a video that explains the campaign. Gloria Huang, senior social engagement specialist at the Red Cross, says her organization is using its promoted tweet area to showcase a new video, which is part of a broader holiday giving campaign. It's nice to have more customization in the profile, she said. We're going through a bit of a brand redesign right now at American Red Cross, and it was a good chance to get that out there for the first time on social media platforms. Ms. Huang said she doesn't have enough information to tell if the new layout had made a difference, but she does believe that the tweet and the video have seen much higher traffic than usual. Going forward, she said she believes the organization will be using that space to show videos, slideshows, and other multimedia. Well, today we are joined by Sharon Simpson-Joseph. She is joining us today to discuss the nonprofit organization Juvenile Justice Fund. Sharon is the executive director of the Juvenile Justice Fund, otherwise known as JJF. JJF is a nonprofit organization and home to a Future Not a Past campaign and the Voices Project, which is a statewide campaign to stop the prostitution of girls in Georgia. The campaign addresses the issue through a four-tiered strategy of research, prevention, intervention, and education. Its mission is to protect and inspire hope in our girls, the true victims of this illicit practice, as well as to disable demand and prosecute the pimps and johns who make the prostitution of children a gruesome reality in Georgia. Through Sharon's career, she has practiced as an attorney, advocate, and national speaker. She's a graduate of Stanford Law School, member of Stanford Law Review, and member of the California State Bar. She served as legal counsel to Mayor Tom Bradley of Los Angeles. She's practiced corporate law, directed a dropout prevention program in Watts, California, and has taught constitutional law and marketing for nonprofits at the University of Judaism. Sharon is the author of a book entitled And How My Spirit Soars, Learning to Pack for an Extraordinary Journey. Well, my goodness, Sharon, that's quite an introduction. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, Sharon, first, tell us about the Juvenile Justice Fund. It's a wonderful organization, and as I've got to know you, I think that you support a very needed, unfortunately very needed and challenged situation, and it's one that is actually a little awkward to talk about sometimes. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the organization and what do you do?
Certainly. First of all, thank you so much for having me here. It's really an outstanding opportunity to share with your listeners the work that we're doing and the work that is needed in this arena. So the Juvenile Justice Fund, we're a nonprofit organization. I would say we're pioneers in the arena of juvenile justice. By that I mean we're a nonprofit, but we're very uniquely based at Fulton County Juvenile Court. And Fulton County Juvenile Court is actually the largest juvenile court in the Southeast. So many, many children are coming through the system there. Because we're based at the court, we have the opportunity firsthand to work very directly with the children and to work to make a difference in their lives. You talked about our programs, and I would say that we're probably best known for our work in the arena of fighting against human trafficking. Now, that's something right now, it's an issue which, thank God, is starting to get a lot of local attention and national attention, and people are realizing that while they thought it was something that was only happening really overseas and in other countries, that it's happening right here, not just in our backyard, but really our front yard as well. Sadly, Georgia is actually one of the states that has the highest rate of the prostitution of our children. The good news is that there is a collaboration that's doing something about it. For us, as the Juvenile Justice Fund, what that means is that we are working to get girls off the street. If I may just give an example, about 10 years ago when we first started doing this work, I'll just use an example. It's kind of a dark one, but it's the reality. Little girl, as young as 10 years old, actually have a picture of a 10-year-old girl in an orange jumpsuit and chains, standing before the court. If that visual isn't bad enough, then the reality of what she was being charged with is as well, because what she was being charged with is prostitution. So she was being charged as a criminally as a prostitute. The thing about that is I want to also emphasize that both the pimp and the, quote, customer, a.k.a. the John, were nowhere to be found. So this little girl was standing in the court, representing the entirety of what that crime is. That was 10 years ago. The good news is that since then, JJF has been a part of leading the charge to change not only the perception, but the laws in this arena. So therefore, while at that time that little girl was a 10-year-old prostitute, today she's recognized as a victim. She's recognized from a legal perspective, from the type of services that are offered and provided, and also from the type of programs that we have that work to help that little girl to make a difference inside of her own heart as well.
And this is such a tragic area. I know that you and my paths have crossed before at several speaking engagements that we've done where I've actually spoken to the topics of human trafficking as well. And so it's a pleasure for me to be able to get the horrific story out. Unfortunately, the dealings that I have had with the FBI and the criminal, what I would describe as justice system, depending on which report you read, Georgia can be ranked number one. It's certainly in the top couple. Talk to us a little bit about, as the organization, I mean, this just is such a difficult topic to even bring up. How do you even go get donors? We're a finance radio show, and I can't help but not only allow you the opportunity, and I want you the opportunity, we will talk about your organization and more about how people can get information on you to be able to support you. But how do you even go to somebody and help educate them to understand the problem is in their front yard, as you've put it, and then ask them for a donation? That's got to be tough.
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. And it is tough. It's very tough. And three ways, I think. The first thing is that part of it is that people just don't know. So for anyone that's listening to this broadcast and who's learning this for the first time, I can't help but believe that that person is feeling something deep inside right now saying, oh my God, I can't believe this. But the reality is it's true. And once someone gets that this is really happening, the next question that occurs to people is, what can I do? And so I will talk later about some of the ways that one can get involved. But one of the most pivotal ways that you can do something is by giving, is by donating. How does that happen? Well, once people hear about it, people actually become eager to donate. It's the learning process of understanding this is really happening and accepting it that's the tough part. So if you're at that point now where you get it, then what I would say is how we donate is as follows. One, of course, is just very directly going to our website.
What is that website?
That website is the juvenilejusticefund.org. And again, I'll just repeat that. It's juvenilejusticefund.org. And we do have an ability to donate very directly on there. And the funds go directly to help to fight to stop human trafficking. And I'll give a few examples of that, one of which also builds upon another way to donate. One thing that we do is we provide community ambassador trainings through our Future Not a Past campaign. What these are opportunities, once you hear this, you can come out and come to a community ambassador training. It's just for people in the community. There are people who come who are politicians, CFOs, teachers, WAMs, that's work at home moms, all walks of life who come together in a community ambassador training, or you can have one that's sponsored by your church or by your program to come out and get a training to understand more of what's going on. Because then as a community ambassador, first of all, you have the opportunity to donate very directly to our program to support the initiatives like I've just described. But second of all, you become an ambassador, simply someone who believes that this is not acceptable and who spreads the word and who's just aware and lets other people know. Because through education and awareness, that's what's raising the collective consciousness that says this is unacceptable. And that's what fuels the legal legislative system, as well as the response from law enforcement to enforce stopping this type of heinous activity.
Now, a question for you. I know that several years ago when I got involved in the topic of human trafficking and the work that you do, at the time we were working to help support you from an advocacy perspective to change the view and the perspective of that young girl. And this does, by the way, to the listeners, affect young boys. Your organization supports children, but primarily young girls, because that is the primary target. But at the same time, these girls were being looked at. Often they have, I forget the statistics and perhaps you can quote them, but it's something like 80 or 90% of these young girls, the first violence they've received was at home. They've fled that violent situation and they're often on the streets. The FBI that I've spoken to and the prosecutors, as well as the justice system that supports these young children, they talk about the fact that they typically find them in the shopping malls, and that they are walking separately alone. It's somewhere that in the winter it's heated, it's lit, there are restrooms, there's a place where they can feel comfortable, and because they're essentially fleeing some kind of victimization. And that's where, unfortunately, their new, let me say, employer finds them. So that in that regard, has the law changed legally to look at them as a different perspective, as a victim, or is it just the judges in the court system that look at them that way?
You have done such an excellent job of describing what's going on for these children, and I appreciate the fact that you said that it's girls and boys, because it is, and that's just a shame. So what's happening right now, and what's happened over the course of 10 years, is that there's been really a lot of reform in terms of the transformation that the laws have gone through. So it's not just the discretion of the judges, which is so pivotal. It is actually laws that support an understanding. One of, I think, maybe the most pivotal laws to mention is the fact that now there are heavier laws, heavier sentencing, and understanding that no longer are these crimes a misdemeanor, but they're a felony. And the crime, I mean, is the crime of pimping, for example. So whereas at one point, slap on the wrist and you're back out the door and on the street grabbing another child, now we have really high sentencing for pimps and for those who are engaging in the practice of human trafficking. Strong state and strong federal laws that really are a strong deterrent, we hope, from people taking that journey. Right now as well, in our Future Not a Past campaign, and that's really part of, we work with a coalition of different organizations and stakeholders and community leaders and concerned citizens throughout the state who are working to also make change and stop demand. Now, that's really touchy, because when I say stop demand, what I'm talking to also is, you know, is people, men in the state of Georgia who are actually buying our children.
And are these people that are coming into the state for the service, or do they reside here, or both?
Well, you know, I think early on we wanted to hope and pray that they were flying in and flying out. Now, some are. And, you know, of course, we have an airport here that is a hub as well, and that's part of it, but it's only a small part of it. Our Future Not a Past campaign did a study of basically who are the men that are buying our children here in Georgia. And first of all, we realized that 7,200 men each month, and I do want to repeat that, because the first time I heard it, I thought, wait a minute, they must mean each year. But no, it's each month, 7,200 men in the state of Georgia are buying or soliciting to purchase sex from our children. And the thing about that is that at least 45% are outside the perimeter. And what I mean also is, when I say outside the perimeter, I mean so in North Georgia. You know, so it's a statewide problem. And in addition to that, when I say outside of Georgia, I mean who reside there. So not visitors coming into town. And that is a huge and important distinction. The good news is, if there's any, is that as this word spreads, it's having, you know, people here in Georgia, we all who live here, saying that's unacceptable. And beginning to take a fresh look at what's going on and how we can spread the word and how we can stop that practice.
So let's talk a little bit about the challenges for the girls that you support. My understanding is that very often they're put through some kind of drug addiction or alcohol environment in order to, quote unquote, give them the ability to perform whatever it is they got to do. What kind of challenges do the girls have when they come to you? I know that through the time period of Juvenile Justice Fund, you've had safe houses for the girls. Your focus is on not only preventing, but the girls that you find through the justice system, you try and get them back to what I would describe as a normal life. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine that you're trying to get them foster care. Explain to me, because I perhaps only know the tip of the iceberg.
Sure. So I would say this. First of all, I'm sitting here and I'm glad right now that we're a radio show and not a television show, because my eyes are tearing up and I'm getting choked up just talking about it. I think it's what allows me to do this job, because I care passionately and the people I work with care passionately. But it's also what, you know, what keeps us up at night and keeps us dialoguing about the fact that we should have stock and tissues. That's my tip.
Okay.
My tip for the day. But so the thing is that for the girls, there are so many challenges. But a few things I want to emphasize. One of the you made the point earlier about the fact that a lot of our girls are girls who are also victims of child abuse and sexual abuse, and that's very true. And so that's, you know, that's that history in there of trauma. You know, and trauma is something that literally I think sometimes is underexplored, I think I just made a new word there, but in terms of how we look at the impact that it has on our lives and in our ability to manage situations and handle, it's a very devastating thing. So the violence that the girls have gone through is also impacting how they're handling their lives now. So specifically, one, we founded the first safe house in the Southeast. It's called Angela's House. And it really broke ground with an understanding that the victims of commercial sexual exploitation often need to be removed at times from the environment in which they're in the worst cases, in order to be able to get the type of wraparound services and care that's needed. So right now in Georgia, we actually, and when I say we, I mean collectively the different safe houses that currently operate, have about 24 beds. And that's actually about half the beds in the nation, which also gives you an indication of just how much more is needed in this arena. That said, though, when we have girls at safe houses, what that does is provide kind of, you know, literally a 24/7 shift in environment. We have, you know, health services, mental health services, improved access to education. And then, of course, the other missing link, which is really about healing, about self-esteem building, about relationship and familial building, because a lot of times there's a sense of what this pimp offers is an alternative to what doesn't exist, which is a sense of family and belonging and, you know, people believing in you. And of course, eventually then, of course, the girls find out they're believing in them for the wrong thing. But when they first bring them in, it's like, hey, here you go. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to give you love. I'm going to give you food, shelter, etc.
So these girls essentially are removed from being young girls.
Oh, absolutely.
They're robbed of that childhood. They don't have little toys. They don't skip along the highway with friends.
Robbed of so much. I do want to emphasize, though, that there is also a turn in terms of an understanding that oftentimes, so sometimes now you have girls who may have, you know, a loving or supportive family member who just doesn't know what to do in that circumstance, or where you also have the girl living in a circumstance where once she walks out the house and starts walking down the street, she's prey to whatever else is going on in that environment. And there's a lot of challenges that exist in that way too. So I guess really what I'm kind of offering are several different visions of what girls are challenged by, so that even when it's a circumstance that she's supported in the house to the degree that the parent or guardian can, there's still these other external challenges that are going on around. You have a school system here in Georgia, which, you know, sadly, I know we're all working to improve it, but we're, you know, probably, what are we, like 48th in terms of, that's a guess, it's 48, 49, 50, around how our school system is rated. And education is one of the key things that a lack thereof, you know, has children also in this type of circumstance, you know. For us as the Juvenile Justice Fund, I am happy to say that there's now an organization in place called the Georgia Care Connection. And it is, it's by the governor's office and children and families. And it's wonderful that the governor's office has really responded and taken a look at this and said, no, this is unacceptable here in our state. So I do want to give a little good news report and say that recently the Shared Hope International, which is an international organization that fights against human trafficking, did a review of all the states and did a ranking system. And we actually came out sixth in the nation in terms of our powerful response to fighting against this issue. That's the good news. We have so much work left to do, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate being able to actually talk about this and knowing that there's listeners out there hearing this and saying, hey, wait a second, what can I do now to make a difference? Because once your eyes are opened to this issue, you can't shut them.
And the first step is to educate yourself. Can people become a volunteer?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. A resounding yes. There are so many different ways to get involved. First of all, I do want to reiterate again our website, which is thejuvenilejusticefund.org, and just reaching out to us. There are many ways to get involved. You can get involved directly with even being able to involved in the community ambassador trainings. There are ways in which you can be involved. We now have a program called the Voices Project. It is a project that works with girls who unfortunately may well be on the road to being vulnerable to commercial sexual exploitation of themselves. By that I mean they're already coming through the juvenile system, so they're already on probation. They have these red flag indicators that let us know that they're in danger and vulnerable to this. Most of them are already victims of some form of child abuse or sexual abuse. However, they have not yet hit the point where they've been commercially sexually exploited. And our goal is to make sure that does not happen. And that's not an easy thing to accomplish. And the girls that we're working with right now are doing an amazing job of working to turn their lives around. And we are just the guides and the partners with them in that process. So our affirmation, if you will, is yesterday I found my voice, today I'm here to shout about it. And that's what we are inspiring in the girls. So in terms of getting involved and making a difference, we have all sorts of wonderful projects that we do throughout the year with the girls. So we, you know, invite different experts in if you're a chef, or, you know, so many of the girls have expressed the desire to write. A few of them have talked about wanting to be a lawyer, and there's certainly a lot more lawyers out there than just me to talk with them about what's the journey like, what does it take in order to accomplish this, what do you need to look for inside of yourself, and what do you need to look for positively externally in society. just a whole shift in how they see and envision the world.
So that's a good explanation of your programs. Let me delve further into how do you fund your programs? Do you receive federal or local state support? Do you receive corporate donations, individual donations?
I'm nodding, but to answer it verbally, yes to all of the above. We receive federal and state funding. Now, in the federal funding arena, so the Juvenile Justice Fund, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're based at and housed at Fulton County Juvenile Court. So we actually have an opportunity to work with children in a variety of circumstances. And we actually have a federal grant from Health and Human Services for a project that partners with Family Drug Court. And in Family Drug Court, we have moms who are going through drug court and their children. And so we get to work with the children and the moms and provide a variety of services to help, you know, really kind of shift the generational, poverty and challenges and drug and alcohol abuse that can occur. That you referenced earlier as well. So that's mm-hmm. a federal grant that we get for that program also. On the state level, we get a grant from on victims of crime. That's a VOCA grant. We receive United Way funding, Fresh grant also from the state of Georgia, as well as a lot of wonderful private foundations that, you know, just ongoingly believe in the work that we do and who really are our partners in this initiative. The Anderson Foundation has not only been outstandingly supportive, but have been and are visionaries in this arena of doing this. And of course, the Atlanta Women's Foundation has been one of our earliest ongoing friends and supporters, and notably when we founded Angela's House too.
So let me ask you, in that regard, you receive federal funding, you receive state funding, but I don't think I heard you say you receive any funding specifically for human trafficking. Is there funding out there that exists for that?
Yeah, two things about that. One, I think it's emerging more and more. So just in the past few years. So a lot of that's right. The grants that we get are writing the grant and describing our program, which is fighting against human trafficking. But in most of those cases, that's not the very nature of the grant. However, these type of grants are beginning to evolve. And we are really excited that there's such an interest now in fighting against this.
Is there a federal, I don't know the term, bureau or department that manages human trafficking? Is it, I know that I've worked and had dealings with the FBI. Is it one of those federal?
Even with the GBI here in town, they've recently opened an entire new unit that's very specifically working and fighting in this arena. So there is a large, federal response and state governmental response and different entities that are overseeing this issue. Some of them, of course, are, under other umbrellas, but I think that's kind of typical until you hit the point where you're talking about president. So
sure.
So I would say there is a strong governmental response at this point, and that it's growing as we're getting more and more. Like if you take, I'll use the state of Georgia. So the, governor, highest form of governance here in Georgia, the governor's office of children and families, that's the group. And then under the governor's office of children and families, they established the Georgia Care Connection. And the Georgia Care Connection's entire mission is to serve the victims of commercial sexual exploitation. So that, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's probably a good model. And then there's funding that comes down the pike, and that often comes through the Georgia Care Connection itself or through the Georgia Office of Children and Families, and then goes directly to the different service providers that are doing this work. And then as other grants come out, either at a federal or state level, we have the opportunity to collaborate and to apply for them. And
now
that's been great.
As a nonprofit, revenue in a for-profit environment, you have salespeople, and they go out and they target companies. Mm-hmm. And they focus on that. How do you even know when grants become available?
Well, we got actually have a fabulous grants officer on our staff. who does an outstanding job of staying on top of what grants are coming out. They're just some wonderful kind of like grant watch, even databases and things like that, that you can always check to know when things are coming down the pike. In addition to, and of course, then once you really get known in this arena, which we are, we'll even receive, letters or emails saying, hey, we're going to be putting out a grant and we would love for you to be able to apply for it.
And what is your success rate? Because it's the grants, the ones that I've seen, it's almost like when I remember back 25 years ago writing my thesis in university.
I think we have a pretty strong, I apologize because I really don't have a percentage, so I can't give that. But I would say I think that we have a pretty strong success rate in terms of the grants, especially, some of the larger, like some of the state ones that I was talking about. And I think it's because we've been doing this work for a while. So even as we evolve a new vision, for example, in the arena of the Voices Project that I described, that project is really a prevention and early intervention project, as opposed to some of our earlier work in this arena where it was, for victims. This is to stop the victimization. And I really appreciate the level at which our grantors and now new grantors have believed in our ability to make this shift and to go upstream, if you will, and to start reaching our girls at an earlier point. And there's been a lot of response and support for that. Similarly with the Future Not a Past campaign, the campaign started out in 2007, so it's very well known now, and yet we keep on evolving it and doing new and cutting edge things, even within the arena of stopping demand. And as I said, we just have such a strong partnership and collaboration with other entities around town. So we partner together also sometimes for grants also. I do want to emphasize, though, that in terms of our reaching out to corporate sponsors, that is something that I really would like to see increase. I believe in the past years, it's been tough sometimes for corporations because this is a touchy, scary issue. But I believe also that everyone is starting to realize that it's imperative that we make a difference in this. So I think that it's becoming an area where we're not experiencing the same level of kind of, shall we say, fear or concern or off-puttedness. And I really do want to encourage corporations who are listening to this to consider beginning to partner even more effectively with us. I, as the executive director, really have a belief in strong types of, public and private sector partnerships and a real vision for that. So I've got some really innovative ideas that I'd like to see us put into place. And we definitely want to encourage corporate partnership and encourage corporate partners who are visionaries to want to be early adopters in this particular arena of making change.
Understand. And certain aspects of you being a nonprofit and the charitable aspect of your cause, I would like to dig into. But at the same time, I've got my CFO hat on. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the elements beyond perhaps the fundraising and the financing. Many times when you look at nonprofit organizations, one of the challenges from a finance and accounting perspective that exists is how to really balance achieving the controls that are required. In a for-profit company, there are requirements for Sarbanes-Oxley if you're publicly traded. There may be requirements from bank or lending sources that have reporting requirements, or there may be a regulatory in industry requirement for certain aspects of tightness of controls. The challenge when you get to a nonprofit is there's always that financial focus from the donor as to how much money you spend on the administration of the organization versus the cause and the mission. And so at the finance aspect, that brings in a challenge of how do you achieve the controls that you need? And how do you balance that with the fact that you are receiving donors' money and you need to have the same safeguards over your assets of not only physical building, but equipment, personnel, but also cash and process. So how do you balance that control focus within the tight deadlines and budget that you have as a constraint?
So first of all, you have described my job quite well. It sounds like my job description. and that's the thing. I think the first thing that you do is that you make sure that you recognize that those type of requirements are exactly what needs to happen. You know, because I do think, sadly, for a lot of nonprofits, the mission and what's in one's heart is such a driving force that some of those things kind of fall along the wayside or are never recognized because there's not an understanding that, in point of fact, when you're managing a nonprofit, you hold yourself to a very high standard in terms of what you are trying to accomplish, literally in regard to social change in the world, but you have to hold yourself to an equally high standard in terms of how you're managing the organization and managing it effectively as a business. And it's a very delicate balance, a more delicate balance than when you're running a corporation. You know, and you mentioned that I'm an attorney by training, and I have done some work in the corporate arena in municipal finance and so on. But in this particular arena, so I bring that, you know, to bear, and I have got a wonderful board that also recognizes that delicate balance, but that commitment to how do you manage this organization as a business as well. So A, I think it's a recognition that that's what needs to happen. B, an understanding of, well, what does that look like then? Because even if you know it, if you don't know how to apply those principles, you're still at risk and challenged. C, the areas where you're not aware of it, bringing in people who are respected and trusted, who are experts in that arena, who can help in that. And again, you talked about the balancing of costs. So sometimes that looks like, you know, being able to, let's say, have a board member who has that level of expertise, who is committed to volunteering their time. And sometimes it means making that delicate balance of being able to bring in an expert who can help you to make sure that those things are in place and it's money's well spent. I also think it's building a very strong and talented team, and then also being creative in terms of how you design your infrastructure so that you can make sure that while you're accomplishing these goals, you're doing it in an extremely cost-effective fashion. So I know, for example, that you earlier interviewed our interim controller, Gloria, and Gloria Beck has just been outstanding at helping us to really just check, double-check, and triple-check and make sure that, in point of fact, we have the level of checks and balances that we need, and that we have systems that are not only going to run efficiently and effectively with excellence, but that are also going to be tailor-made to the needs of our organization as well. And I think that's the challenge of being a nonprofit, because you are, at times, we're, you know, small to medium-sized entity with a huge commitment to making a difference there, but also with a huge commitment to having an organization that's run extremely appropriately and well, you know, and we go through an, you know, annual audit and so on. And we hold ourselves to a high standard, which is appropriate, because the alternative is that while you've got this commitment to getting out there and doing this great work, if you can't run your organization effectively, in the end, you won't have that organization.
Yes.
And everything will, you know, be in vain from there on.
Yes. So in that regard, do you have particular aspects of coordination of programs? In fact, do you account for programs on a separate standalone basis? Does each program need to maintain its own budget of revenue and its own budget of costs?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things that's unique about our organization from a programmatic as well as a fiscal perspective, because, you know, we're the Juvenile Justice Fund. We have our mission, All Children Always Matter. Well, it takes a lot of forms because, you know, we've got the children in our court who are oftentimes the ones who are lost, forgotten, most at risk, that a lot of organizations would be too challenged to even effectively serve. And those are our kids. Those are who we serve. That's a huge commitment.
What's the youngest child you've ever served?
Oh, gosh.
I've heard the FBI quote six years old.
Yeah, I sadly, unfortunately, that is certainly a accurate age. I think probably, I'd say that, yes, but that would be the exception to the rule. But probably, I think maybe what's as tragic is the fact when you talk about like a group of 10, 11, and 12-year-olds, like when you realize that age is not that unusual. Yeah, so that's what I would say about that. Yeah. But yes, we do, because we have varying programs, like the A Future Not a Past campaign that I described is an entire Stop Demand campaign. And then our Voices Project is a whole direct service initiative to the girls, as well as really being a I almost want to say kind of like a think tank in the arena of making change in the area of prevention and early intervention, specifically as it pertains to the dangers of CSEC. Those are two, well, they're sister programs. I got caught in an acronym. That's the commercial sexual exploitation of children. But so they're sister programs, and, you know, one's fighting to stop demand, one's fighting to stop supply. I'm certainly on the right program to acknowledge that, you know, unfortunately, oftentimes stop, you know, the commercial sexual exploitation of children it's a business. Mm-hmm. Scary.
And I know from having spoken on the same stage as your lead speaker that there are, I forget the statistics, I think it was something in the range of 20-something billion dollars per year worldwide. This is quite an industry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If we're going to talk numbers, this is mm-hmm. big business.
Yeah, it truly, truly is. And that's the other thing that
And it's also untaxed.
Yeah, well, good point, good point. And I think that's the other, yeah, really. That's the other thing that makes it so frightening, because that's a heavy incentive for, you know, a lot of people out there who are involved in this business to fight against, you know, having it stopped. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it means we've got some real challenges ahead of us in terms of how do we stop this. Mm-hmm. But we've got some amazing people that are every day joining the struggle, and amazing corporations. You know, I just heard word that, you know, so a few key lead corporations in the country have just also, you know, put out a public word saying that they're going to be working to stop this and putting money behind it as well. So that's outstanding.
That's fabulous. Mm-hmm. Now, as a CEO of a nonprofit, what keeps you up at night?
Okay, can I come back and do like three or four other shows on that? Oh, Lorraine, what keeps me up at night? Yesterday, we did a program. It was a recognition of our Voices girls, who have just done an amazing job of working through so many challenges to get to the point where they are. And what by that I mean that they're doing better in school, and doesn't mean that they're still not having serious challenges. They are. But to say, hey, great job. And as we...
And these are girls that have come through the program.
Right. And who are, in fact, for the most part, still on probation. So still actively going through these challenges. And yet it's a road and a journey. It's like Rome wasn't built in a day. And so when you see, you know, the girls doing better, feeling better about themselves, understanding and embracing this concept of yesterday I found my voice, today I'm here to shout about it. Because what that means is that they're recognizing that they have a voice, that it's a voice that can be used positively and powerfully for
themselves.
And is
the voice enabling them to say no?
I think so, absolutely. It is, and that's the thing. And enabling them to become leaders within, you know, their schools and their community to encourage other girls and boys to say no. So it's a paradigm shift. It's very gradual, but it's a paradigm shift. So what keeps me up at night, though, is one of the girls that I'm picturing, and each girl was getting to stand up and kind of declare what she used to dream of being and what she dreams of being today. And the acknowledgement, of course, being that we even have a dream. And this girl, she was trying to talk about what she felt today, but she got choked up because part of what she wanted, and her grandmother was sitting there in the audience, so she just started crying, and she said, "Grandma, I'm trying, and I want you to be proud of me."
That's tough, and I can see that you're choking up as mm-hmm. as it is. Well, we have a tradition on the show to ask all of our guests, and I'm going to have you put your finance hat on, because I know you as a person that you actually have done a stint in finance, and I think that that's one of the very strong facets that any CEO, your title executive director, brings to the role of leading a company and an organization. So here comes the question, Sharon. What is your CFO tip of the month?
Okay, my CFO tip of the month is, when you're running an organization, and I'll focus specifically on the finance piece. When you're running an organization and you're holding yourself to a standard and running it, and you've got a good policy, procedures, etc. in place, if you spot something that's not working, and you realize, okay, wait a second, and that's appropriate. If you think everything is working well, smoothly all the time, then you're probably not focusing as closely as you need to. When you spot something that needs to be that's not working and that needs to be modified, do the assessment, understand what's going on. Don't run off half cocked. But once you've done the assessment, act. That would be my tip of the month. Don't let it, because I think it's kind of that concept of when you don't act, then it just kind of, you know, it's weeds, and weeds don't go away. You have to pull them out. So I would say act, take steps and address it, and then powerfully move forward.
That's a great tip. And Sharon, this has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I'd like to formally thank Sharon Simpson-Joseph for being our guest today, sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the plight of the children that you serve and the role of finance as it affects the nonprofit that you serve. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
And let's give one last shout out. If people want to contribute or to learn more about volunteering or just to learn more to educate themselves, give a shout out for the website.
Certainly. Once again, it's the juvenilejusticefund.org. So juvenilejusticefund.org.
Thank you very much. And thanks also to our contributor, The Chronicle of Philanthropy. Thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks also to our sponsor, the National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. You can see their website at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. And for those of you that have been listening for the 2 years that we've been airing, I would also like to give a shout out that once per month we do have a guest on our show that is a nonprofit organization. It's a way that we can give back to the community. So we're very specifically looking for CEOs and CFOs of nonprofit organizations, large and small, to be guests on the show. Thanks to listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.